Welcome to our 50th lesson in the book of Revelation, which I've entitled The Conundrum of the 144,000. We'll be looking at Revelation chapter 7, verses 4 through 8. And of course, it has to do with the 144,000 that are being called out. And there's probably no section of Revelation that is more misunderstood and more confused than this passage right here. It's because the church basically became Gentiles, because the Jews rejected it by and large as a group. And as Paul said, I will now go exclusively to the Gentiles, for they will hear the gospel. And we see this transition in the book of Acts. And thus, by the second century, the church was largely Gentile, and then on it became primarily Gentile. Jews, by and large, were very rare to enter into the church, saved into the church. Obviously, during periods of persecution, Jews made false professions of faith so that they could stay alive, but never really changed. And this was going on as late as the 19th century, just to let you know. But this misunderstanding of what is going on here is based on, number one, bad hermeneutics. Number two, bad understanding of Bible history. You're kind of making it up, reading into the scripture to achieve your goal rather than get the meaning out of scripture. This misinterpretation about the 10 lost tribes of Israel and replacement theology led to cults and misinterpretations of this passage. And yes, replacement theology is a false belief the Gentiles have replaced the Jews because the Jews killed Christ, God got angry with them, and he took away his promises from them and gave it to the Gentiles. Except he didn't. And it's written in the Bible that he didn't, as we're going to see as we go along. Now, the Shemites, their methodology of dealing with conquered peoples was to move in and take certain elements of the conquered peoples and ship them off elsewhere. That would be the politically, militarily, and financially enabled people, because this is where your trouble will come from. These are the ones that have the most stake in keeping the society that they were in going. In other words, rebellion. But if you take them out of there, the masses will just sit there. They'll just farm. They'll just make. They'll just do whatever they do because, by and large, the masses don't care. Easily manipulated, easily fooled. And what they would do when they conquered other people is bring those top elements in and plop them in on top of the ones that you'd already pulled out. And this is how they tried to prevent these societies from rising up in rebellion against them. Sometimes it was successful, other times not so much. In fact, from the Persians onward, this fell into disfavor and was not used again. Persians broke the practice of this captivity and exile and emigration out of the area. Of course, the Persians were not Shemites either. They were Japhethites. And there's no basis in scripture for replacement theology. So Israel, we're talking about the northern kingdom after the United Kingdom divided in 1 Kings 11 through 26, 11:26 through 39. And under Jeroboam, who rose up in rebellion against Rehoboam, who was king of Judah after Solomon died, he brought the 10 tribes down to the coronation and said, "Hey, you got to re reduce the taxes, reduce the work projects. You got to ease up because it's too much." And Rehoboam said, "I don't think so." And thus Jeroboam said, "Okay, we're leaving. I got all the people here. I got most of them all around Ephraim. I got them. 10 tribes. You want to do this, you're not going to be king of much. You'll just be king of David, of Judah, of Jerusalem, of the temple, and basically one of the smallest tribes there, Benjamin. That's all you got. That's all you're going to be." And thus Jeroboam became the first king. Now, what he did was revive the golden calf worship and then replace the festival of Passover and unleavened bread and the spring festivals with one he made up to keep people from going down to the temple in Jerusalem. He says they go down there, they do that a few years, and pretty soon they're going to say, "Where are we divided again?" "I don't know. Let's join together." And then, can't have two kings. And I'm a son of David, so you know whom they're going to eliminate. Now, he did this even though God told him, "Don't do this." God said, "I will give you 10 kingdoms as punishment to Solomon." Because Solomon, with his idolatry and promotion of idolatry, did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And God told him, "I'm ripping 10 tribes away because you've gotten too big for your britches. I won't do it in your lifetime, but I will be doing it afterwards." And you brought it on yourself. And Rehoboam did bring it on himself. He was given an opportunity to say, "You know, we can renegotiate this." But he didn't. He did follow in the footsteps of his father that he knew. Now, if you don't understand the golden calf worship, you have to go to Exodus chapter 32 and read about that. And it's really an interesting passage if you read it closely. Moses comes down off the mountain. People are having basically a idolatrous worship orgy, drunken orgy. And he goes to Aaron and he says, "What happened?" Aaron says, "I don't know. You were gone a long time. People got scared, got concerned. They said God killed you, and they need something to rally around, or they were going to dissipate. And so they gave me this gold. I threw it in the fire, and this golden calf came out. I don't know what happened. Not my fault." And that literally is what he's saying. "They gave me the gold. I threw it in the fire. The calf came out. It was a miracle. So we worshiped it." Now, obviously, it grew out of Egyptian idolatry, and we've talked about that in our study in Exodus. But for our purposes here, it never went away. It was always in the background. It was always associated in some respect with Ashtaroth and Baal worship. It never disappeared. And so Rehoboam revived it. It was in their history. People would understand it. They would gravitate toward it more closely. In fact, in the Northern Kingdom, it was very influential, as we're going to see here in a few moments. And he built two of them, one up in Dan, the very northern part, and one down in the very southern part of the Northern Kingdom called Bethel. And he took the Passover and he renamed it and redirected it. So they could have their festivals. You can have your Christmas. It just won't be about, well, you can say Jesus the baby, but it won't be about Jesus and sin and salvation. It'll just be about the baby and getting stuff. Or Easter and the bunny and the eggs and the getting stuff. But it won't be about salvation and sin and penalty for sin. It won't be about any of that. Well, this continued. There were no good kings in the northern kingdom. And eventually Assyria conquered Israel and led a portion of the wealthy and industrious people into permanent captivity. Hence the myth of the 10 lost tribes. Why 10 lost tribes? Because in a cursory reading of the scripture, you assume that they took the entire population or almost all the population and marched them down the road to another country. Now, this just doesn't make sense. In fact, when you look at the Babylonian captivity, which happened 100 or so years later, you see there were three successive waves, and it wasn't all the people. They left the poor, they left the masses, they left most of the tradespeople in the land. Why? Because they're not going to rebel. They don't care. They just want to eat. They just want to see the grandchildren. They don't care about truth. They don't care about right. They don't care about anything except me. What do I want to do? And as long as you don't interrupt me, I don't care who's there. And we see this prevalent today. It's trying to get people to understand what is occurring in America around them, and they don't care. Belief persistence and belief suspension. As long as they can continue their activities, they do not care. And it's the same back then. So the politically powerful, the militarily powerful that you left alive, and the religious and financially powerful, you trotted them down the road to the next kingdom or so. Now, they would not be a part of that society. They would be outsiders. They couldn't agitate. And then when you conquered another people, you did the same thing to their upper echelons and moved them into Israel. And thus, it was just poor hermeneutics, not reading the scriptures properly, that people came to this idea that the 10 tribes were lost. They were never lost. They never went any place, by and large. In fact, if we go to 2 Kings 17, verses 21 through 24, it said, when he, meaning God, had torn Israel from the house of David, they made Jeroboam the son of Nebat king. And Jeroboam drove Israel from following the Lord and made them commit great sin. The people of Israel walked in all the sins that Jeroboam did. They did not depart from them until the Lord removed Israel out of his sight, as he had spoken by all his slaves, the prophets. So Israel was exiled from their own land to Assyria until this day. And that's true. As a political entity, Israel ceased to exist. Period. It became part of Syria, it became part of that area, you know, the province of Assyria. And then when Assyria was defeated and passed off the scene, it got incorporated into part of Babylon and then part of Persia and so on and so forth. It became separate, but it was never again allowed to be Jewish because they weren't Jewish. By and large, they had forsaken it. Now, there were some who tried to hang on to it, but it became clouded. It became confused. And you know them in the gospel times as Samaritans. And thus, there was this internal conflict. But Samaritans are basically false Jews who got confused because of Jeroboam. Now, there were some who did get saved. There were some who did come to Jerusalem and hear, you know, participate in Passover and do these things. And you read about that even during this time period. There were some in Israel who remained faithful. Some were killed for remaining faithful. But to prove that they were not lost tribes, we go to 2 Chronicles. And when we do that, we go to 2 Chronicles chapter 30. And what we're going to see here is that Hezekiah, during the Passover, sent emissaries up north to the conquered area and invited people that were there. He sent letters to Ephraim and Manasseh. They should come to the house of the Lord at Jerusalem to keep the Passover to the Lord. And so they decreed to make a proclamation throughout all Israel. That'd be the northern kingdom, from Beersheba to Dan. Beersheba in the south, all the way to Dan in the north. Invite people to come and keep the Passover. And they came. Not all of them. Some of them came. So the couriers went from city to city through the country of Ephraim and Manasseh as far as Zebulun. But they laughed him to scorn and mocked him. However, some men of Asher and Manasseh and of Zebulun humbled themselves and came to Jerusalem. And the hand of the Lord was upon them. And so, no, they weren't lost. They'd gone anyplace. And there were some faithful. And they did come. And they did keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And they did keep the Passover. In fact, they kept it for a couple of weeks. They said, we're having a good time. Let's extend this. We're uniting in fellowship. And God's moving upon us. And we're growing and developing. And so we see that the 10 tribes were never lost. However, Enlightenment heretics and poor hermeneutics believe the 10 tribes, and this is where it begins to get hilarious, even in the 18th and 19th century, the people ruminated that the 10 tribes, well, they weren't lost. They just came to America and became American Indians. That'd be the Mormons. And see, the Mormons believe they could be part of the 144,000. The how you keep count of that list, especially as you grow in numbers and time goes on. They never explain clearly, but it's limited to 144,000. So I don't know how they're going to count for all of that. Some have said, well, the 10 lost tribes, they didn't go to North America. They went to the islands and became Great Britain. Or they went to the islands and became Japanese. And medieval believers even saw the 10 tribes as allies to conquer the Muslims that had retaken Jerusalem, being further east in that area. But you know, son, God did not lose his people. Let's go to Romans 11, starting in verse 26. And this is the problem. When you read the Bible in light of your understanding, you're only going to find what you're looking for. And in this way, all Israel will be saved, as it is written, starting at verse 26. Deliverer will come from Zion. He will banish ungodliness from Jacob. And this will be my covenant with them when I take away their sins. As regards the gospel, they are enemies for your sake, but as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their fathers. For the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. This is an indicative statement. Indicative. It's not conditional. The gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. There is no replacement theology. There is only misinterpretation by the ignorant and the false teachers. We do not want to fall into those groups. We do not want to give rise to cults that pretend to come from the Bible but don't. It's a form of godliness but denying the power thereof. Thus, the 10 lost tribes were never lost. Gentiles never replaced the Jews in God's plan. And Jews aren't going to replace the Gentiles. Each has a place in that plan. Now, man cannot determine who are these people. That's what we're going to learn in our lesson. You'll never know who they are. They don't know who they are. They're not supposed to know who they are, because they're not going to be marked until that time. Then they'll be marked. Angels don't know who they are. Only God does. So Christ knows and marks them for the angels. Because as we're going to see, and as we've learned in past lessons, that is the ministry of the angels, to help those who carry the gospel message of salvation. So what's in a number? We have to go back and look at this. So let's start in verse 4. And I heard the number of the sealed, 144,000, sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. Now we have to deal with the number thing. And people have written over the centuries that it's just a large number. It has no meaning in and of itself. It's a mystical number. It has special magic properties. It's not an actual number. It is an actual number. And so when you read the references, you get very confused. Because when you buy a reference or you go to a reference, you should read the preface first to see what they actually believe. If they're honest, they'll tell you what they actually believe. But even if they're not honest, you can pretty much figure it out. And thus, anytime you read it, somebody else's interpretation of the Bible, you need to understand, what do they actually believe? And do they have a clear understanding of it? Just because they claim to have an understanding, or just because they were more closely aligned with what you believe to be the truth in Romans or the Gospels, doesn't mean they have a clear grasp of Revelation or Proverbs or Psalms. So you can't be an expert in the entire Bible. You can, but that's several lifetimes of study. We really don't have that much time on earth these days. And so let's just approach this from a biblical perspective. Let's look at the numbers. God designed the solar system and galaxies as measures of time and signs to us. Genesis 1, 14 through 19. And so the year, a solar orbit of 12 months, whether you have a lunar or solar calendar, the Jews and many of the ancient peoples had lunar calendars. Today we pretty much follow the Romans and have a solar calendar that's off a bit. but establish 12 as completion. In other words, nobody has redefined the year. French during the French Revolution, primeval socialism tried to redefine the week and work days and the calendar and all of this, and it failed miserably. It's locked within us. It's a pattern that repeats. And it has since creation, day four. And so 12 carries this number of a completion, of a journey that completes, and a journey that completes over and over again. It's completion. We tend to think of 10 in groups of 10, 10, 20, 30, God's fingers and toes. But it's time. You can think in groups of 10, and we do for our numbering system and always have in physical elements. But in terms of time, we don't think in the decimal. We think in groups. There's the group of 12. And how many hours are there in a day? There are two groups of 12. And so you have this evolution, the duality that repeats. 12 in the daylight, 12 in the night. Though they wane and wax as the seasons do. And so 12 is the reason that God established 12 tribes. And it's the reason he called 12 apostles. And yes, Judas, man of Iscariot, was not one. He was called, but he rejected that calling. And so he was replaced by Paul. So there's still 12. Now we have to look at 10. 10 is the multiplying the effect of the attached number. So if you have 3, which is God's Trinity complete within itself, and we see 3 as the smallest enclosed figure in geometry, the triangle, it's able to bear weight, which is still used quite frequently in architecture. It's this completion of God in number, the Father, Son, Spirit. Man, body, soul, mind, or body, emotions, and mind, intellect. We always think in these groups of 3. And when you say that 3, you get that sense of, yes, it's complete. It's enclosed. It's contained. And so with this, and you multiply that with the 10, you have 3, now you have 30, or 300, or 3,000. Then you get this, my goodness, that completion has been magnified. That effect of God has been magnified. That effect of man has been magnified. And so you see where we're going with this then. So you have the 12 tribes or apostles, the complete number for God's purposes. Each tribe has 12 times 10 to the third power, or 12,000 called out. And they are called out. Remember what we've said in previous lessons, that when Christ descends, the sound, the voice of an archangel, sound of a trumpet, the church rises up to meet him in the air. They hear the sound, come! And they rise up to meet him in the air. Well, simultaneously, these guys also hear the sound, come. But it's not to rise to meet him in the air. It's to come out from among them is to come out and be revealed. It's you I have called. Me? You called me? I heard the sound. And they are come out into the world to be revealed in the world, carrying out the gospel. And then you get this sense of duality, this emphasis. It's not just 12 times 2, it's 12 to the second power, or squared, or 144 times 10 to the third. In other words, it's intensified, it's magnified, and this is where you get the 144,000. This is just completion upon completion upon completion upon fullness upon the Antichrist, Satan, demonic world, the world system, even the flesh are powerless against God's recalcitrant reality. And this is the number. And he tells them beforehand. And Satan would love to know who these are and kill them the moment they're born. Actually, try and prevent them from being conceived. Nobody knows. The angels do not know. But what this does is it emphasizes the Jews' ministry since they were first called out as a people. Turn to Exodus 19:5. Let's go there. God tells them right up front that they are going to be a people, a priesthood. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you should be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. So it's not just a calling out to be a people separate from all others, the least of all nations, but to be a kingdom of priests. Obviously, they never achieved that. They had the Aaronic priesthood, and they didn't do too good a job in teaching the people to follow. You didn't even teach the Jews to follow God. We'll return to Isaiah 61:6. Starting in verse 5, strangers shall stand and tend your flocks, foreigners shall be your plowmen and vine dressers, but you shall be called the priests of the Lord. They shall speak of you as ministers of our God. You shall eat the wealth of the nations, and in the glory you shall boast. And so in the millennial kingdom, the nation shall be a nation of priests. And of course, in Zechariah 14, we see this come to fruition. And thus, this is why they're called forth. They are going to take the gospel into the world. The church is gone. They didn't do that good to begin with. Never has the church had this many missionaries on the field at any one time. Not even close. This is a tremendous amount. So we're looking at the list. And let's go back to our passage and let's look at the list. Judah, Reuben, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, Manasseh, Simeon, Levi, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, Benjamin. We're missing a couple. In fact, when you compare these lists throughout the scripture, they seem to change a lot. And you're going to say, and you're saying, did not God know who the 12 tribes were? Why does the list change? Why are some added? Some deleted. Why are some lists not even 12? Some lists are only 10. Why? We have to get the context. to understand what is happening. Now, we're not going to go and look at every last thought about it, but it really would detract from our focus on this list. However, what we can understand is understanding Bible history helps to understand Bible prophecy. So if you find the Old Testament boring, you find the genealogies boring, then you're never going to understand biblical history. But if you go to Genesis 34, you see Simeon and Levi led the slaughter of the men of Shechem because the ruler's son raped their sister. Now, to his credit, he said, I love her. I want to marry her. And he was actually being sincere in that. He said, I did it wrong. I know I did it wrong. I was overcome, but I do want to marry her. And Jacob was willing to let bygones be bygones. Simeon, Levi, and the other brothers, not so much. They said, well, you have to be circumcised, and otherwise we can't marry you, and you can't marry into us, and that's not going to happen. Now, what's going on here? Satan had set the sons up. He set Jacob up. Because if they can intermarry here with this town at a very early stage, there'll be no people for Christ to come through. And so there was never a question about joining together, as the men of Shechem suggested. And the brothers were right. We can't intermarry if you can't marry into us if you're not circumcised. Now, if they had been honorable and honest, they would have just left it at that. But they conned the men of Shechem into being circumcised, which immobilized them for a few days. Then the brothers would be able to go and went in there and killed them all. All the men. Slaughtered them. Jacob, oh great. Everyone around here is going to now retaliate against us and slaughter us. We're going to have to make a quick getaway. And later on in Genesis 49, 5 through 7, when Jacob is pronouncing a blessing upon his sons before his death, he never forgot how they conned him. He never forgot how they tricked and destroyed these people. Two wrongs do not make a right. I don't know if your mama taught you that, but God does. So starting in verse 5, Simeon and Levi are brothers. Weapons of violence are their swords. Let my soul not come into their counsel. O my glory, be not joined to their company, for in their anger they killed men, and in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. And so this was specifically applied to Levi. Because from Levi came the Aaronic tribe, priesthood. And they were to be scattered throughout Israel. Levi had no portion of their own. They were given select cities in each of the other tribes' areas that they occupied. And of course, they were the priesthood and Jerusalem at the temple. And so you need another tribe to complete the 12 tribes because Levi was, well, they were scattered. And that's one of the reasons they're not included in most of the lists. In fact, if you were to look at the encampment around the tabernacle in the wilderness, see, the Levites were on the very inner part. And thus you had three tribes on the east, south, west, and north. That's 12. And so, but you got one tribe right in the middle around the tabernacle, because they're the priesthood, they're the workers, the other sons of Levi that have duties to keep up with the tabernacle. And even Moses was a Levite. And he was in that inner area. And so where are you going to get the other tribe from? And this is where Joseph comes in. Because remember, they sold Joseph. They booted him out. They didn't want to have anything to do with him. And of course, you read in Genesis how that the famines came. He was prepared. He was promoted as vizier in the land of Egypt, though he was still a slave. He was made just below Pharaoh. And long story short, if you don't know it, he brought his family into Egypt and protected them, even though they had rejected him. But he was given the daughter of a priest, and he fathered two sons of Manasseh and Ephraim, Manasseh being the eldest. And so sometimes, depending upon context, Joseph is not included either, but he's replaced by one of his sons. And so Levi is replaced by one of the sons, and Joseph's not in the list. He's replaced by his other son. And so oftentimes you'll see Ephraim and Manasseh. In fact, Jeroboam was from the tribe of Ephraim. And half the tribe of Manasseh stayed east of the Jordan, half the tribe stayed on the west side of the Jordan when they entered the Promised Land. So sometimes, depending on context, what is the emphasis here? You'll have Ephraim and Manasseh rather than Joseph and Levi. Yes, they're sons, but once again, Levi is scattered. It didn't have a land area. And it was the priesthood, so all was seen separate and distinct. And Joseph often is replaced by one of the sons. Now, let's understand about Levi and his fierce anger, which led to Shechem's slaughter. If you think about Moses, what was Moses' besetting sin? Anger. It was anger at how the Egyptian overseer was treating the Jews, that Moses went and killed him because he got angry. He didn't think it through. Two wrongs don't make a right. And of course, he thought he was doing it in secret. Obviously not, because he was confronted by that the next day. And he says, great, now everybody knows. And so we read about this in Exodus 2, 11 through 15. So he had to run. And this is when he went into exile to keep from being executed himself. And then, in Numbers 20, 1 through 13, at the second trial of Meribah, Moses' temper gets the better of him again. Not the only time, but the last time. And God told him, speak to the rock. And Moses compared himself with God before the people and said, how long must we contend with you? That'd be God and me. And this was going to be a problem, because they're already thinking of him in the place of God. And so, yes, he was the intercessor between them and God after the 10 words in Exodus chapter 20. But here, he himself was beginning to see himself as equal with God. And we can't have that. No one is equal with God. And so he struck the rock. And God let water come out. But anyway, because of mercy. But he told him, because you and Aaron did not honor me before the people, you two don't get to enter the Promised Land. And he didn't. So his anger flowed from his ancestry. Now, that doesn't mean other people in other tribes didn't have problems with anger. Obviously, they do. But it is a hallmark of the Levitical tribe. In fact, the Levi's tribe, righteous anger at the golden calf was, and going, whipping out their swords and going through the encampment, slaughtering those that were clinging to the calf or refusing to give up the calf or not repenting about the golden calf. This is what established the Aaronic priesthood. Anger. Anger. And we see this at the trial of Christ. High priest stands up and screams out, tearing his robes, anger. What need have we of witnesses? He has condemned himself. Kill him. They start torturing him. Totally against the law. And we see this in Matthew 26, 57 through 66. Because the Aaronic priesthood had one function: to examine and find the Paschal Lamb acceptable for sacrifice. And this they did with Christ. In anger. So this is the final list of the 12 tribes. And what we learn is that the sins of the fathers affect the sons. God warned that each person is responsible for their own sin. Absolutely. Exodus 34, 6 through 7. Every person is responsible for their own sin. My father sins, I don't have to pay for it. Neither should my son pay for my sin. Unless, of course, they do it too. Now it's personal accountability. However, the sins of the fathers influence or shape what the children believe. We see this in Proverbs. And not just the fathers, but the mothers also. So we're going to say the parents. They shape how the children perceive truth, how they develop. And thus, the sins of the fathers affect the family, affect the group, the three, four, or more generations. So why is this important? Well, let's go back to the golden calf in the wilderness in Exodus 32. And Moses ground that thing up and made those people drink it, the powder. You know, as he gave everybody heavy metal poisoning. Because that's what idolatry does. It poisons you. It poisons your mind. It poisons your body. It poisons everything and keeps you from life. But it didn't end in the wilderness. In fact, it continued and had Levitical influence. So if you turn to Judges 17 and 18, which is too long for us to read, you'll see there was a guy there named Micah. And he's an adult son. And his mom's well off, very wealthy. And it's the period of the judges. Everyone does what's right in their own eyes. And mother is whining that somebody stole her 1,100 pieces of silver. And I'm going to curse him. God gonna come get him, beat him up, kill him. Or somebody will. And Micah heard this. And he repented. He said, I did it. I stole it. Here it is. He said, well, I'll give you a portion back. Not his inheritance later on, but I'm going to take 200 pieces of silver and we're going to make an idol. And guess what? There was a traveling Levite who's looking for something to do, looking for an occupation. This temple stuff's not working for him. Because remember, the Levites depended on your offerings to live. And if they didn't get offerings, they had no way to make money directly. And if they weren't in the temple, they probably weren't getting any offerings. So they had to look for things to do. So this guy was a traveling Levite. And Micah said, well, today's your lucky day. I need a Levite to help me worship my idol. Levite says, I can do that. And here we have Levitical contamination. Now, this is foreshadowing because you get to the last book of the Bible, the Old Testament, book of Malachi, and God is railing upon the priesthood for leading the people in error. And it began with strange fire, but it continues in Judges, and it continues in the Kings and the Chronicles and the history books of the Old Testament. Well, the tribe of Dan was just never able to conquer the Canaanites in their assigned area. So they just left. They were a small tribe. They just left. And traveling up way north, they came across Micah's place, decided to rob him of his priest and his ephod, his priesthood, his idol. And they took him away. And they told Micah, you keep following us and whining, we're going to kill you. There's one of you, there's a few hundred of us. You decide what it is you want to do. So he had to go back home without his idol, robbed, but with his life. Upshot is, we have more violence. Dan goes way north, and they find a town that's isolated, and they destroy it, rebuild it, settle there, recast the idol into a golden calf. And guess who their priest is? The grandson of Moses. See, Moses' son, because Moses' wife never believed. Thus her children never believed. And their children did not believe. So because she did not believe, her sons died in their sin and remain in their sin now. And their grandchildren died in their sins, evidenced here. So when you go to Judges chapter 18, starting in verse 27, what do we see? Let's go to Judges 18, 27. But the people of Dan took what Micah had made and the priest who belonged to him, and they came to Laish, to a people quiet and unsuspecting, and struck them with the edge of the sword and burned the city with fire, because there was no deliverer, because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone. It was in the valley that belongs to Beth Rehob. And they built the city and lived in it, and they named the city Dan after the name of Dan, their ancestor, who was born in Israel. And the people of Dan set up a carved image for themselves. And Jonathan, the son of Gershom, the son of Moses, and his sons were priests to the tribe of Danites until the day of captivity of the land. So they set up Micah's carved image that he had made as long as the house of God was at Shiloh. In other words, they embraced this dialectism. They were part of the problem. This idolatry is nothing more than what we would call today the hermetical dialectic, resulting in captivity. False Jews. And so when Jeroboam got the idea for the golden calf throughout all the northern kingdom, it's because it had been there ever since the period of the judges in the northern part of the kingdom. He didn't have to force it on the people. It had been percolating throughout the culture for hundreds of years. And it was in the wilderness. But it couldn't be too bad because God didn't stomp it out. And so it was their go-to idolatry. It was their go-to religion. It was their Catholicism. It was their Greek Orthodoxism. It was their Methodism. It was their Episcopalianism. It was their Baptistism. It was their family stuff. See, we're doing it. We're sitting in church. We got to be saved. No. That's not how it works. And thus, the sins of the fathers were visited upon the children continually. This doesn't mean individuals can't be saved out of the group, but the group itself, as a whole, culturally embraced this. But God will save individuals and does so. So the perspective is, why do they place it here? Why is it in this passage, stuck right in the middle between the sixth and seventh seal? Because remember, we still haven't gotten to the seventh seal. Well, why is it here? Well, remember, the seals are about the beginning of the great tribulation. The effects that are flowing outward from sin. And the effects, both positive and negative. You have this people of God, and you have people not of God. And rocks fall on us. Well, the church is called out, as we said. It's been replaced by Jews who are also called out, revealed to the world. This is their calling out. This is the tribes. Jews were the gateway. They've always been the gateway. They've always been the means that God comes out, works outward through the world. Then, and it will be again. Remember, without Jews, there would not be church. Church actually is a copy of the synagogue system developed during the Babylonian captivity. They are the Jews of the scripture repository. They were the ones to bring gospel to Gentiles. Well, that was their function, but they really didn't do it very well. But it did turn out. Did not Jonah go to Nineveh? Reluctantly. Yes. But he went. He wasn't happy they got saved, but he went. And this is just the attitude of the Jews then and now. It's not about people being saved. It's about me. It's about what I want. And I want to be king over everybody and everybody be slaves. And that sounds a bit harsh. You should go and study the Talmud and the Midrash and the Mishnah. This is what they want. That's not what God does. They think they know God, but they do not. So we're not going to put Jews on a pedestal calling them God's chosen people, and whatever they want to do today, that's fine. God doesn't work that way. They have been banished for a while. Romans 9, 10, 11 discusses this in great detail. But they will be called out. They will be called back. And the beginning of the Great Tribulation is when this occurs. They will be called out. Their efforts encompass the entire Great Tribulation. It's not just the beginning. They're going to be at work throughout the entire period. And they're going to be greatly persecuted for it, as we're going to see later on. So this is an overview showing that while majority follows Satan's lie, even today, remember that vast majority of the poor that stayed in the land? Why? They were no threat. They weren't going to uprise. They're going to go watch their TVs, live with their families, have a great time, talk about the game, talk about the shows, talk about the entertainment. They didn't care as long as they could do the same things that they always did time after time after time. Truth? I don't believe no truth. Doing right? Don't have to do that as long as I get to eat every day and get to go to the show. Why do I care? And they don't. So they follow Satan's lie. But Christ remains at work using his people, in this case, the true Jews, harvesting his people, Jews and Gentiles, from Antichrist. So these Jews are marked. They are the wheat. If we go back to Matthew 13, 24 through 30, we talk about the wheat and the tares. These are the wheat. Now everybody knows who they are. The demons know who they are. Satan knows who they are. Now the angels know who they are. And they're kind of discovering who they are too. Now, do I believe that in an instant, in a miracle, 144,000 will just walk, march forward, Bibles in hands, company encompassing the world? I'm not even sure 144,000 would be even called it at the beginning. This might be a total number that occurs throughout the tribulation. It's a complete number, because God's complete number of those who are to be saved will be saved. Ephesians 1, 3 through 14. Whoever God has called to be saved, Romans 9, will be saved. Nothing can stop that. But that also shows the angels whom they are to assist, because this is their job. Hebrews 1:14. They are ministering spirits sent to minister to those who are to be saved. Now they know who the wheat are. You already know who the tares are. Everyone's conceived in sin. Everyone's lost. You're born lost. You're born a tear. Outwardly, that's what you look like. That's what the angel said in the parable. The worker said, we can't tell the difference. That's right. Wait till harvest. Then you can tell the difference. Wait till they're marked. Then you can tell the difference. The Great Tribulation is the beginning of the harvest. I will tell you who to mark, because Christ, as God, knows his people. He knows his own. He knows his sheep. They hear his voice. And when they hear his voice, they will come forth and they will pick up the Bible and they will read Hebrews. And they will go, ah, it's not the Aaronic priesthood anymore. It's the priesthood of Melchizedek. And that means Christ. And boy, did we get that one wrong. And so when you read Hebrews in light of this background, yes, there's things Christians can get out of it, absolutely. But think about it. If you were the marked Jew, and you had this inner desire to know truth and to love truth and to teach truth, and it just comes on you, and you're reading this, and oh, I never knew that. I didn't understand. And the Holy Spirit is opening your mind and teaching your soul, and it's just pouring, and you want to take it out. You don't want to sit on your butt 6 days a week, go to church on Sunday for an hour or two and forget it the rest of the time, and be like the masses that don't care about truth, as long as you can pet your dog, love your cat, hug your grandchild, watch your shows, why do you care? They love truth. They have a newfound love of truth. They are saved. That is the way we are to be, even today. And it leads to this large harvest that we're going to talk about in our next lesson. Thank you.